Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 25th of May. I don't know if you saw, but it's a terrific article in the New York Times Sunday Magazine section. If you're wondering at all about who the players are and how Race to the Top became reality and how it is functioning and what school reform should look like according to the administration and those who are opposed to it, the reasons for their opposition, read this article. It's the Teachers Union Last Stand. And this hour of the program, we will have the author of the piece with us and also one of the people who is featured and is a big, big person in the whole school reform field. We're going to start with John Schnoor, CEO and co-founder of New Leaders for New Schools. He works to drive high levels of learning and achievement for every student by attracting, preparing, and supporting the next generation of outstanding principals for our nation's urban schools. He took leave of New Leaders for New Schools for the months of September 2008 to June of 2009 and served as an advisor to Barack Obama's presidential campaign, a member of the presidential transition team, and a senior advisor to U.S. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan. He served as Special Assistant to Secretary of Education Richard Riley, President Clinton's White House Associate Director for Educational Policy, and he also served as Senior Advisor on Education to Vice President Al Gore. He is, according to this article, the person who really knows everything about school reform in this country and has moved the whole debate to a political front burner. And some could say that Race to the Top is really his idea. We're going to be welcoming phone calls for John. And later in the hour, Stephen Brill, co-founder of Journalism Online, founder of Court TV, and author of the piece in this past Sunday's New York Times Magazine will join us. Did I give you the number? 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that as well. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. We also should tell you that John is from the Milwaukee area. He's from Shorewood. And John, thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Yeah, a great pleasure. You know, it's interesting that one of the things that got you involved in this whole movement is you were editor of your high school newspaper, and a transfer student from the Milwaukee schools was at your school who was probably more savvy than anybody on the staff but didn't have very good skills, and you wondered why.
That's right. I was the sports editor of the Shorewood Ripples at Shorewood High School back in 1983 and 84 when I graduated. And we had, at that point, the 220 program where kids from the Milwaukee public schools were bused into the suburban public schools. And high school, we had a number of students who had been in the Milwaukee schools through the eighth grade and became good friends of mine. And one was applying to be a reporter, a writer on our high school newspaper, and she was extremely insightful and savvy. She submitted a piece to the newspaper, which was just awful in terms of the writing. She had simply not learned how to write in the Milwaukee public schools. I just couldn't figure out how we in the country and public education in Milwaukee hadn't been able to help a brilliant young woman like this learn how to write well and became very focused on what could be done to change that for others who were coming behind her.
And why do you think she never learned how to write well?
Well, I think that, my great-grandfather moved to Milwaukee from Europe in the early 20th century, and at that point, he's always a huge fan of this country and all the opportunity and freedom that was afforded. He probably had about the equivalent of a elementary school education, and that was enough 100 years ago to be able to get a good job and raise a family and become a leading member of community. And I think what's happened is many of our urban school systems across the country have continued to educate kids at the elementary school levels that were needed 100 years ago, but are far short of what we need today. And I don't think schools have gotten worse, but the huge problem is that our schools must get much better to prepare young people for the success that's required in today's economy. And I think our schools haven't closed that gap. And while there's a lot of hope in places, I think that this young woman was a victim of the fact that our schools hadn't adapted to a new economy and a new era.
How did she do eventually? Do you know?
You know, I don't. I wish I did, and I should sort of through friends try to find out. I imagine she found some way to succeed, given how talented she was, but probably not to the degree that she could have had she had a better education.
Right. The article indicates that you were the brain person behind the Race to the Top. Is that true? Was it your idea?
Well, I think anybody who thinks that one person could play a role in being responsible for something like that is not really seeing the amazing set of forces and people who've come together to create kind of this opportunity in American education. You know, I think the most important thing we've got right now is we've got these proof points at school levels around the country, including Milwaukee, where kids from all backgrounds, including kids in poverty, are really succeeding at very high levels in a way that hasn't happened before. And they are showing that our kids from all backgrounds can achieve at high levels when we adults do our part right. What hasn't happened is doing that at scale, and I think a lot of the evidence that created Race to the Top was based on what happens in pockets, and a lot of people came together thinking about what it would take to get that to scale, and the key person that made that happen was the president, at that point the president-elect of the United States, and in the stimulus negotiations, the president-elect Obama and President Obama made clear that one of his non-negotiables for a stimulus package would be an investment in education, both to avert layoffs and to invest in reform through Race to the Top.
What is it when you look at Race to the Top that is most crucial in reform? Is it the quality of teaching in the classroom, John?
Well, it is. I mean, the most important, the research is very clear, and as you know, I think those of people who spend time in school know this too, the most important in-school factor driving improvements in student achievement is the quality of the teacher and the quality of the teaching. And the second most important is the quality of the principal and school leader. Research shows that 60% of the difference between school-to-school student achievement gains can be attributed to the quality of the teacher and principal. And you know, this is our teachers right now are our heroes in society, but we haven't done nearly enough systemically to lift up the profession, invest in our teachers, and help them achieve at the very high levels they need to meet the age of today and tomorrow's economy rather than last century's.
We are, as you know, nationally facing a huge round of teacher layoffs right now. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, again, I think President Obama has exercised such extraordinary leadership on education. And I think what his formulation was for the stimulus package last year, I think is still right. You know, he was the one to basically say, look, let's in our stimulus package last year include $100 billion for education out of an $800 billion package. And what that included was mostly funding to invest in schools and avert cuts. His program has averted hundreds of thousands of layoffs across the country, and he invested in reform of education and focusing on teacher and principal effectiveness, expanding high-quality charter schools, turning around low-achieving schools. But the funding for layoffs, to avert the layoffs, is now running out, and the economy is getting better, but not quickly enough. And so, you know, I think it's imperative, and they may or may not do it, but the Congress acts to continue both the reforms through efforts like Race to the Top and help avert layoffs so this wasn't just a 1 or 2 year stopgap, but we can kind of stop the bleeding until the economy recovers over the next couple of years.
Tell me now about the point system. Give us a little outline of what Race to the Top is. I don't think too many people know the intricacies of the program, John.
So for specifically what Race to the Top does, so $40 billion out of the $100 was set aside for states to avert layoffs and keep teachers working so that in this economy kids wouldn't lose their teachers at such a crucial time. But $4.3 billion was set aside in a competitive grant program for states, which is very unusual in the federal government because usually the money just gets distributed to everybody regardless of merit. There was a competitive program established where states could apply for a share of $4.3 billion if they adopted large-scale reforms and policies that would take the small-scale successes that we've seen in our schools to much larger scale. And in particular, the most important criteria for getting awarded a Race to the Top grant is investing comprehensively in effective teachers and principals at scale and taking very significant steps to really change and lift up the teaching profession while also ensuring that there are much higher standards and much better tests for our kids, good data systems to perform improvement, a very aggressive focus on turning around the low-achieving schools. We had one round of the competition so far, and only 2 out of 40-plus states that applied won. I think that's a very powerful message to the country that this isn't business as usual. This funding is only going to flow in exchange for significant improvement and reform, and the deadline for the second phase of the competition is coming up next week, June 1st.
So you're looking at testing as a measure of teacher performance. You're also looking at some subjective areas, which we'll talk about. But let's talk about testing for a while. As you, I'm sure, well know, teachers have complained that they have for some years now with No Child Left Behind, having to be teaching to the test. And so you have huge amounts of time in the classroom devoted to preparation for the test, to taking trial runs of tests, at the neglect of learning perhaps about the Vietnam War.
Yes, I would say in many areas of our society, including education, I think we can kind of divide ourselves into kind of these false camps that take one side of the issue, as opposed to saying, how do you work together and bring out the best of both sides? And I think this has happened on the testing front. So there has rightly been a focus on trying to ensure there's more accountability and improvement in education for kids' performance. Can kids really master high standards? Can they reach the high standards that are needed to be ready to succeed in college or a career? And the testing that's been put in place in the country, you need some metrics to do that, has been very, very imperfect. I think there are those who would say, let's keep the status quo of testing, which I think is problematic because testing is, in many cases, implemented in ways that drives test prep, which undermines the kind of higher quality instruction that we need. And other people say we should roll back and eliminate testing. And I think, and the president has been leading on this, what we really need is much higher quality assessments used well, assessments that don't just have kind of fill in the bubble multiple choice tests, but look at writing and analytic and critical thinking skills and really measure what our kids need in order to succeed in today and tomorrow's economy. And I think with the president's leadership supporting states that want to set higher standards and better assessments, we'll have much better assessments as opposed to the same old bad assessments or rolling them back.
And do those need to be national assessments, John, or state-by-state assessments?
Well, they'll be state-led assessments. I think the real exciting prospect on here is there's been leadership from across the country. It just shows how much leadership is coming in and for education across our entire country. 48 states have banded together voluntarily, including Wisconsin, to say, we're going to set a new high common, not federal, but national standards that are optional for states to buy into. These standards have been worked on with experts and with state input over the last months and years. They're going to be unveiled June 2nd. And they really are going to be the best standards that have ever existed for our expectations for what our kids should be able to know and do in math and in English and reading and communications. And the standards will be optional, and states can adopt them. But again, 48 states are part of the process and hoping that most of those states, including Wisconsin, will adopt them. So they'll be national but state-led and not federal.
And I know that you were working in the area of principals, too, and talked about the importance of a principal in a school. I agree with you. They're incredibly important. What do you do to ensure that you got the best principals in districts throughout the country?
Well, see, there's been more of a focus in the country on teacher quality, which is important. But you can't have and keep great teachers at scale without a great principal. I've never seen a school turn around without a great principal, somebody who can really set the tone, bring the community together, hire the right team members, retain team members, develop a real sense of focus on high achievement for all kids. Most importantly, I think we're seeing a shift in the principalship. It used to be that school systems expected the principals to be perhaps the disciplinarian, manager of the bureaucracy, maybe keep parents happy. What we're seeing in the best schools, making the best progress, is a principal who really is taking responsibility for student success, who really is great at helping teachers teach effectively, and who sets a culture in the school of high expectations for all kids and personal responsibility among the adults for student outcomes. And that shift in the principalship, I think, is one of the most welcome changes in education. We've got a few superstar existing principals who are leading the way, and we're learning from them all. And meanwhile, we're trying to give a lot of training to help people understand what's working in those principals in those schools who really are getting these dramatic gains that we're seeing in some of the historically low-achieving schools.
We talked about testing and keeping a long track of students' records. What are the subjective factors that Race to the Top is looking at when it comes to teacher performance, John?
Well, there's real flexibility there. What Race to the Top asks for in terms of the focus on teacher performance is that we, instead of looking at teacher inputs, so what courses they've taken, what certification they have, the inputs alone aren't what really matters. What matters most is whether a teacher is effective based on multiple measures. And the Race to the Top asks states to set and school systems to set definitions for teacher effectiveness that include, as one measure, and this has gotten a lot of attention, a look at fairly measured improvements in student learning. including based on state assessments. So it's not looking at the absolute scores, but are kids making progress? And one of the things a teacher of reading or math ought to do is ensure that there's real progress with help from the school for their kids. But most of the states that are really adopting this kind of reform are making that measure 40 to 50% of the metric, and 50 to 60% of the metric are other factors, like observations of how well is the teacher engaging students, how well does the teacher, you know, keep a well-managed classroom where kids can keep focused on learning, really doing the things that the research shows drives long-term student outcomes.
We all know, if I asked you to list your five best teachers, you can remember those moments in the classroom and you can remember those teachers, and they probably had a profound influence on your life, as they did everybody who's listening. And it's hard sometimes to figure out what it's an amorphous quality. Maybe it's engaging students through their great love of a subject, knowledge of a subject, and enthusiasm to impart that subject to their students. But that's a hard thing to get at in terms of determining whether a teacher is a top-notch teacher, isn't it?
Well, I'll tell you, first of all, I want to say I had the incredible privilege of attending the Shorewood Public Schools, Lake Bluff Elementary School, the middle school, and then Shorewood High School. And I benefited from extraordinary teachers. If I started to name them, I wouldn't be able to stop, because I had so many great teachers in the Shorewood Public Schools who helped equip me to succeed. Went to Princeton undergrad and beyond, and the experience I had both from teachers as well as the extracurriculars, the student diversity that we benefited from, including through the 220 program, is an example and a driver of that. So I'm hugely grateful. I do think that when you look around the country, that you really can see the difference between the most effective teachers and the least effective teachers. And it's not about test prep. In fact, there were studies showing those schools that have focused on test prep, in the end, kids actually do worse on the tests, because tests, when they're done right, are just a measure of whether there's been really high-quality teaching. And that we really see there are metrics that are showing very clearly the difference between our most effective teachers and least. And I will tell you, the difference for especially a low-income student between getting three straight good teachers and three straight underperforming teachers changes their life. They could be in the top quartile of performance nationally. If they get three good teachers, they could be in the bottom quartile. If they get three ineffective ones, and on behalf of our kids, we got to make sure that the kind of teachers that I was able to benefit from, Shorewood, that all of our kids across the country, and then it's even a harder job, because we got to close gaps that have been created for a long time that are not easy to close. We got to remember this is very, very hard work for our teachers and principals.
You make a good point. You can lose a whole body of knowledge, I think, if you get three math teachers in a row who aren't very good, or three English teachers in a row who aren't very good. You can just lose the subject matter in your life.
Absolutely. And I think one of the problems is that we have in society and in many school systems around the country, there's kind of crept into our thinking a set of low expectations for our students. And differential expectations for our students. And I've been in too many classrooms and schools. While there's great hope and successes out there, I've also been in too many schools and classrooms where the assumption is that a kid who hasn't been learning at high levels can't, or a kid who's a kid in poverty can't learn at high levels, or a kid of color can't, a kid who's an English language learner, a kid with a disability. And there's a mentality sometimes that, well, I taught it, but the student hasn't learned it. And what I've been most inspired by, and the people who are leading this effort to improve our schools, are the teachers and the principals who've gone about this in a very different way and know that our kids can achieve at high levels when they get the right level of instruction and expectations and relationships and support. And they can't do it alone. A school system, the whole community has got to back them in doing that. But I will tell you, the difference between schools and classrooms where there is that high level of expectation and quality of teaching and culture and not is a life or death for many of our kids across the country, and I would argue for our country and for our economy in a globally competitive world.
John Schnur, our guest, the first half of the program, CEO and co-founder of New Leaders for New Schools, featured in a very interesting and informative and thorough article in the New York Times this past Sunday, The Teachers Union's Last Stand. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We take some phone calls now for John Allen from Madison. Hi. Allen, go ahead, please. Alan, you got to turn the radio off. Call us back, please. Eugene and Viola. Hi.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, Eugene.
I'm wondering, our teachers here last year got a 7.6% raise over 2 years. When I was going to normal school in the early 60s, we were taught one thing, that you go out for every cent you can get for the simple reason that we spend more money on alcohol and cigarettes than we do on education. But as a result of that, and the administration couldn't come right out and say this, couldn't admit this, but as a result of the raise that they got over 2 years, they had to let a couple teachers go. And if they hadn't had to, if they hadn't gotten the raise, they wouldn't have had to let those teachers go. And I'm wondering, if the union pushing for wages, how prevalent that is throughout the United States. The union's asking for more money, and as a result, they're having to cut back and let teachers go.
Well, I would say, first of all, there's no one-size-fits-all answer in education, and I think every community is different. Secondly, I would say that, interesting on this teacher union question, and there are those who sort of think that the teachers unions either are only the sort of salvation of education or the enemies. I view it neither way. I think that, like for most of us, I think we all have to change. School systems have to change. School leaders have to change. Parents have to change. Government has got to change. Teachers' unions have to change if we're going to make the leap forward that we need to get better results from our kids. There are teachers' unions across the country who are really embracing, and not surprisingly, given the dedication our teachers have, embracing reform and improvement. And we've had some incredible examples across the country, even in the last several weeks, of teachers and teachers' unions and, quote, reformers who really are working together on common sense solutions to make improvement. So I think that's important to understand. On this particular issue, I think it's a very local question. I would just say that I think there are very the teacher pay and paying teachers well is important. And that I would say, and this is a little bit controversial, but if you had to make the choice between doing what's needed to find and retain the best teachers or have more teachers, even with a little bit lower class size, I think that the premium needs to be on how do you find and keep the best teachers. And I'm not saying that particular decision is the right one as a local decision, but I do think that people need to think long and hard about how to attract and keep and honor our best teachers in America.
And are you at odds, is Race to the Top at odds with teachers' unions when it comes to facing layoffs, who should be laid off first, and it should be based on the quality of the teacher, not just seniority?
Well, the President's Race to the Top initiative, first of all, is a voluntary kind of incentive program, not a mandate. And instead of focusing on punishing, it's more on rewarding and incenting people who are willing to take the dramatic steps needed to make improvement. And now what I would say is that we have states where the leadership in education, the state superintendents, the governor, local superintendents, and the teachers and the teachers' unions are embracing this. And I'll just give you an example. Colorado last week passed legislation that Mike Johnston, who's a state senator there, who's a longtime teacher and principal, authored, to really help change the teaching profession, make it much more of a profession, which both means more opportunity for teacher, more professional development, but also more accountability in fair ways. And the American Federation of Teachers, affiliated in Colorado, worked and worked and worked with Mike. Mike, the state senator, worked with them. And they, in the end, came to agreement on a bill that had a broad coalition of civil rights groups and business groups and educators, the American Federation of Teachers, on a bill that really will change the teaching profession. So I think that this does not have to be done in a finger-pointing or acrimonious way. I think there are opportunities for people to work together on this, and Colorado is one of a number of growing examples of that.
We go now. Thanks, Eugene. Alan in Madison, hi.
Hi. I taught for over 35 years for my teaching career. Part of that time was spent teaching at a high school in inner-city Chicago, and the rest of the time was teaching here in Madison. I think the race to the top emphasis is all wrong. I don't think the problem is with the teachers or the standards or the administrators or getting computers in every class. I think it's a society-wide problem that's not being looked at, such as poverty, the breakdown in the family. I think family attitudes toward education is the single most important factor in how students perform. And along with that, I would throw in support for single parents and the lack of, in general, for support of education. And one last thing, I had terrible teachers, 90% of them, when I was in high school.
90%?
Well, most of the teachers that I had in high school when I was going to school in Chicago were not good. I had maybe, I can think of two good teachers that I had in my whole high school career, and I turned out fine because, you know, I had good family support, and it's not like they were on me for, you know, to do well in school. It was just an assumption that I was... It was an unspoken assumption that I was going to do well in school. And so I think the entire emphasis of the race to the top is totally off base and a waste of energy and a waste of money. And if we address all these other society-wide problems like we should be doing, the education problem would take care of itself.
John.
The key differentiator of the schools in school systems, in communities that we're seeing the most progress, I would say at the highest of levels, is in the end not about policy. It's about leadership and it's about culture. Policy can be new incentives and you cover. The most important thing we're seeing is where there's a willingness and an embrace of personal responsibility that we actually, as educators, can do much better, getting much better results for our kids. We're seeing teachers model this and principals and superintendents and community groups and mayors and governors in some cases and saying, yeah, there are maybe a lot of other problems out there that we can't control, but what's within our control, we're actually going to take extreme responsibility to do it extremely well. And that kind of assumption of responsibility has led, you know, maybe I think since the time you were in Chicago schools, 30, 40 years ago, a former Secretary of Education called Chicago the worst school system in the country. But since then, in Chicago, as an example, there are examples of schools. One example that the president has visited and highlights is the Dodge Renaissance Academy in Chicago, which was one of the worst schools in Chicago. They transformed it, brought in a principal, invested in the professional development of the teachers, really professionalized it with high expectations for kids. And in 2007, that became the most improved school in the state of Illinois. I think that's an example where maybe that didn't exist 30 years ago. Those examples and pockets of success that exist today, showing that education done right can actually help counter poverty, as opposed to assuming that poverty is going to drive educational outcomes. It's a hard job. It's hard work, and we got to give a tremendous respect to people on the front lines every day doing this. But I really think, like, if we as a society rally to help our educators do the hard job of closing these gaps, we've got proof points at the school level that I am convinced that educators and parents and others and students can take to the citywide and statewide level. And Race to the Top is essentially an opportunity for cities and states to race to become the first examples of that. And I hope Milwaukee and Wisconsin kind of come along in that, because I think the opportunities are great for kids in Wisconsin and across the country.
John, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on the show, and thank you for the focus on education. There's nothing more important.
I agree. John Schnur, CEO and co-founder of New Leaders for New Schools, he has been one of the driving forces in putting together and implementing Race to the Top, and he has, isn't it amazing how many people have Wisconsin roots who are on this program? Oh, I went to this school in Wisconsin, and he went to school, elementary school, middle school, high school in Shorewood, Wisconsin. He took time to serve as an advisor to President Obama's presidential campaign as a member of the presidential transition team and a senior advisor to U.S. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan. Also served in education capacities in President Clinton's White House and as senior advisor on education to Vice President Al Gore. We're continuing our topic, so your phone calls are still pertinent to the next half hour of the program, and our number is 800-486-8655. This half hour, we speak with Stephen Brill, who is co-founder of Journalism Online, the founder of Court TV, and he is the author of the piece that we've been referencing all this hour, The Teachers Union's Last Stand, which is in the New York Times Sunday Magazine. And thank you so much, Stephen, for being with us.
Happy to be with you.
It was interesting to listen to John. He's got a lot of enthusiasm and really was a driving force behind all of this. Can you give us a little bit more background? He's sort of amazing how ideas sort of come to us and then there they are. His idea for Race to the Top?
Well, he, when I started to do the piece, a lot of people, just one by one, as I was talking to some of the usual suspects and maybe not the usual suspects, everybody would say to me halfway through the interview, have you talked to John Schnur? And the first time someone said it, I said, no, who's he? Well, he's this guy who worked for Duncan. He worked in the campaign. He's been doing education reform for a long time, and he seems to be at the center of this. And the more I talked to people, the more he came off as the person sort of at the center. And when I talked to him, as you may have heard from your own interview, though I didn't have the opportunity to listen to it, he's relatively self-effacing. He's very enthusiastic about the ideas, but not terribly forward about his own role in it. But
right.
But sure enough, he seems to have been the one who came up with the idea for calling this a contest, which had has had a tremendous impact. Although, I guess I need to say what I did in the article, which is that this was sort of like the spark that lit the fire, and the fire has been ready to be lit for several years. There have been a lot of things going on relatively quietly that have reached the point where now there's literally an explosion of controversy and debate and indeed activity around
yes.
all these issues related to so-called education reform.
Tell me what the importance of charter schools is in Race to the Top and in education reform in this country.
I think in one respect they're less important than meets the eye. I mean, just in the reaction to my article, I've been I'm actually quite surprised at how people focus on the 5 or 10 paragraphs in the article that relate to a charter school, as if I'm implying that that's the answer, which is you scrap the traditional public education system and just, you know, and you farm it all out to charter schools. That can't possibly be the answer, because you couldn't do that and you shouldn't do that. What's important about charter schools is that they serve as a demonstration of what's possible, and there are primarily two aspects to that. The first is that they really completely destroy the myth that successful education outcomes are only about, you know, poverty and resources and family life, and all that stuff's important, but what's more important than any of that is the quality of the teacher in the classroom. And I demonstrate that, I think, pretty persuasively by taking a school building in the middle of Harlem, where half of the building is a charter school and the other half is the traditional public school, and the charter school spends less money, has slightly larger classrooms in terms of slightly more students per class on average, and yet the outcomes are much, much better in terms of, you know, test scores, reading proficiency, math proficiency. So that's the first reason charters are important, is they sort of demonstrate what can happen when you remove big system bureaucracy, you add in an expectation that people can achieve and will achieve despite the fact that they're poor, they may come from broken homes, and frankly, you remove the constraints of the union contract.
Right.
So that's the first thing. And the second aspect of this really is that they demonstrate to parents what's possible, so that it becomes impossible to continue to sort of skate along on the assumption, well, there's nothing we can do for these children until we cure poverty, because there is something being done for these children, and it's right there in the same building. And I think it's fair to say that the education reformers see education as a way to cure poverty, not vice versa.
Mm, interesting. The other thing, though, and the reason that I concentrated on charter schools is because I thought this was fairly dramatic, and I wonder how much a part of education reform this is, and then there are a lot of broader questions about people going into the teaching profession, and these two schools were different in terms of teachers working longer than those who were represented by the union. And school begins in August. The teachers, as well as, I guess, principals, have to have cell phones made available, as you say, by the school, so they're always available, which means being on the job all the time. Being a teacher is such – it's a tough thing to do.
It's really hard. It's really, really, really hard, and it's even harder at a charter school because the hours are longer. You have to be available more, and but – I don't think that's inappropriate. Why shouldn't we want to have the best talent working the hardest in what's arguably the most important, you know, job in the country? The teachers' unions are kind of in an awkward position because to take the position that it's not the quality of the teacher that counts is not terribly consistent with the view I know of most teachers and obviously most union leaders, which is that teachers are really important.
Right. Oh, I wholeheartedly agree. But don't you have to pay them so you attract people to the profession who really are top-notch? A lot of teachers in this country don't make very much money at all.
Well, that's true, but teachers who achieve seniority in a big city school system not only get paid quite a bit, $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 a year, sometimes more, but their pension benefits and their health care benefits are far beyond what I dare say you and I get. So it's quite expensive. In that school building in Harlem, it costs $5,300 a year to fund the teachers' health care and pension benefits. $5,300 a year per student, not per teacher, per student in the classroom. Whereas on the charter side, where the teachers get, you know, very good health care plans, but like you and me, they contribute something to them, and they get a matching 401k, which is standard and it's decent. Those benefits cost $1,300 on the charter side. So, yes, you and I could probably agree that as a matter of, national priority, all teachers ought to be getting paid more, especially in comparison to some of the other jobs that we see people making millions for doing. But with that ought to come some degree of accountability. There almost isn't any job in the country that you and I can think of that's this important where the quality of the performance is just not taken into account when it comes to pay or promotion or whether you keep your job.
Right. Tell me about how this movement has flourished over the last couple of years. It is being debated, of course. It was a big debate here in Wisconsin not that long ago about how the state could get some of the money from Race to the Top. And I'm sure that this is happening in legislatures all over.
Everywhere
in the country, right? So it's going to really, in some fundamental ways, change education in this country. It's just,
well,
it's happening right
it's
now.
It's also a political battle. And in Wisconsin, as elsewhere, the teachers' unions have been very strong. They've concentrated their clout on one party, the Democratic Party, and that has, I think it's fair to say, has colored the debate and colored the outcomes. But in many places, that is changing rapidly because people who are sort of traditionally on the left and traditionally in the Democratic Party, such as the poor and minorities, are the ones who most want to see public education improved, and who believe, again, this is where the charter movement comes in, who believe that there is an alternative in public education that could produce better outcomes.
Mm-hmm. We're going to go back to phone calls. We have tons of people who would like to speak with you. Stephen Brill, our guest this part of the program, co-founder of Journalism Online, founder of Court TV, author of the piece we're talking about, The Teachers Union's Last Stand, featured in the Sunday New York Times Magazine section of this. What is today? Tuesday? This past Sunday, 2 days ago. I'm Kathleen Dunn. 800-486-8655 is the number, and the email is talk@wpr.org. Second hour of our program this Tuesday, Evan Thomas will be joining us. His latest book is The War Lovers, Roosevelt Lodge, Hearst, and the Rush to Empire, 1898. We go to phone calls now for our guest this half hour, Roger in Lone Rock. Hi.
Hello. My question, I'm speaking generally because I haven't researched this, but in the last few years, we've heard different talk about coming up with some testing to assess teachers. And often when that is talked about, both from teachers' union and from teachers, we hear, oh, you couldn't possibly come up with a test that could assess if teachers were good or not. And I went through school. I mean, when I went to public school, I had some very good teachers. I had some not very good teachers. And the way that we were assessed as students was by test. So I find it a really ironic statement from the teachers' union and from teachers that there couldn't be a test that could assess who was good or bad as a teacher. Any comments?
Well, sure. Listen, you know, we've all been tested, and we've had our good days and our bad days, and we've had days when we said, you know, it's stupid that test determines whether I get into college or law school or whatever it is. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you do nothing. And the way the reform people want to assess teachers is by testing the progress of students, not simply, you know, if you're stuck with a very challenged group of students in a class who score low, that doesn't mean you're a bad teacher. The question is, how much can you improve the performance of those students from the beginning of the year, let's say, to the end of the year? And it can be done in some subjects, can't be done in others, and it's not perfect, but it doesn't mean that you simply do nothing. There's a quote in my article from Michelle Rhee, who runs the District of Columbia school system, and she points out that when she arrived there, I think in 2007, 99% of the teachers had received a satisfactory rating, which is just sort of routine, and yet only 8% of the students, I think in the third grade or the fourth grade, were performing at or above grade level, 8%. So her quote is, you know, 8% of the students are performing satisfactorily, but 99% of the teachers are. How can that be?
Thank you, Roger. Let's go to Jennifer next. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Kathleen and Stephen. Thanks for having the program today. I am a teacher. I'm off this year to do some education training, but I have taught in Milwaukee Public Schools, and I've also taught in Madison Public Schools. And my comment is, and questions are, if this is coming from someone outside education, someone telling us that we should do A, B, C, or D, who has never taught and has never been in an educational setting as far as making standards, testing, and I don't think you can test a teacher just on a written test. There needs to be a lot of observation. My second year teaching in Milwaukee, when I was very young, I got what's called a master teacher evaluation. Part of that is because I have very high expectations. I don't think it's just the unions, and I don't think it's just the teachers. A huge part of this comes from parents at home accepting the education, making their children responsible for getting things in on time, for, you know, expanding their horizons. And we are hugely, hugely cut by the, you know, all the districts that are being cut financially. A huge part of my paycheck goes right back into my classroom so my students can have what they need. And I don't think that's uncommon.
Stephen.
Well, I don't disagree with any of that. I'm simply saying, you know, yes, parents are important. Yes, resources are important. But teachers are also important. And to say that because there might be inequality in terms of what's going on at home with a student, in terms of resources, to use that as an excuse not to in any way hold teachers accountable for their performance, I think is something that the reformers just don't accept. And I can't think of any other place in society where we have a job that's that important where we accept the same thing, which is 99% are satisfactory, everything's working fine, except, you know, the patient died or the student didn't learn. You know, certainly that's not a result we accept anywhere else, but we've accepted it for years in education, and I think what's happening is that parents and a lot of people on the Democratic as well as the Republican side of the aisle are saying this is just not acceptable. Mm-hmm. The United States spends, by an order of magnitude, more per student than any other country in the world on education, and yet we rank in the bottom third or the bottom quarter among developed nations in terms of the outcomes, in terms of how much students learn and how prepared they are when they get out of grade school or high school. So something's not working, and you know, simply to say, well, it's all these other factors that have nothing to do with the classroom, just isn't enough for the reformers anymore.
Thank you very much for the call, Jennifer. How do you deal with some of the criticism that has come the direction of Race to the Top? Education is thought of, public education, as the great equalizer in this country. So you have some districts, some states who are getting more money than other states, and money does equate to, you know, more computers or smaller class or whatever it is. But it's not equal.
Well, it's never been equal. And, you know, this is a tiny amount of money. I mean, the oddest thing about this is that, you know, Mr. Schnur's idea worked as well as it did. It's basically less than 1% of all the money we spend on education is in this Race to the Top fund. So that's not really going to determine that much. And plus, to get the money, you have to spend it on new things. So, it's, you know, you can't use it just to hire teachers or to buy desks or anything. So, there are unequal allocations of resources. But again, I'll take you back to the central truth of that building in Harlem, where less money is spent in the charter side than on the public side. So it can't be money.
Mm-hmm. And what's the most important thing you have to do to really come out number one or number two?
You have to demonstrate to the vetters that Secretary Duncan and his staff have hired to read these applications that you're committed and can implement the kind of reform agenda that he has in mind. And the crux of that is holding teachers and principals accountable for outcomes, training teachers, retraining teachers where they're not performing, and ultimately removing them if they're not performing, but paying them and promoting them who, you know, based on how they do perform, so that you encourage and pay more to the really successful teachers.
We go to Bob from Eau Claire next. Hello, Bob. Hello, Bob. Are you there?
Hello. Good morning. How are you?
All right. How are you?
Very good. A couple of things. Earlier, you said you bet you could name a teacher who stood out in your scholastic career. And in my case, I was taught by nuns in elementary school. And as a group, those nuns were spectacular, with minimal resources and with maximum motivation. They really turned out a phenomenal product in myself and my classmates. If I learned nothing else, I learned how to diagram a sentence and to speak a sentence grammatically correct. My daughter currently is a teacher at a charter school north of the Twin Cities in Brooklyn Center. And I watch what she is going through. She works brutal hours for the compensation that she gets. It's a minority population that she serves. The schools, their students themselves are not particularly motivated, although they do respond well to her. And even saying all that, she is seeing a high rate of failure, even with all of her best efforts at trying to motivate these kids.
I need to hold you there, Bob. We have about 30 seconds left. Stephen?
Again, I think that's exactly right. Teachers count. Teachers really count. And it's a really hard job. And there's some who do a really hard job better than others. And they ought to be promoted. They ought to be encouraged. They ought to be recruited. They ought to be paid well. And the ones who can't do that hard job ought to be encouraged to find other jobs.
On that note, we have to say goodbye. We have so much more to talk about, but we will at some point. Stephen, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome. I was delighted to do it.
Stephen Brill, his piece is The Teachers Union's Last Stand. It is the cover feature story in the New York Times Sunday Magazine just this past Sunday. Stephen wrote the whole piece, and it's worth reading because this is a big movement in the country right now. Thank you, Chrissy Pease, for producing this hour, and thanks also to Chrissy for doing on-air production for this hour. And thanks for all of your calls, everybody. We have news coming up and much more interesting conversation for this Tuesday to follow. Going to do a little history about a part of history that's very important and we neglect, so please stay with us. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.